You're listening
to the Libertarian
Atheist Podcast.
How are you enjoying the fall of the empire in all its blazing glory? On one side, we have a fascistic, orange-haired, bankrupt rich guy with a penchant for hating Mexicans and eating tacos. And on the other side, we have a sociopathic, warmongering rape apologist who got her law career started by defending pedophiles and got on the public's radar by failing to push a socialist healthcare plan in the early 90s and looking the other way while her president husband slid his slide in everything he could find. Now, today we're going to be jumping into the history of our inevitable, and it is inevitable, next president, Hillel Clinton. I hate the fact that I have to say it, but statements against her are not statements for Trump. Just because I don't like a turd sandwich doesn't mean I want a vomit burrito. And unlike some of my libertarian brethren who decided to jump on the bandwagon of a man who couldn't give a damn about the idea of freedom, I, on the other hand, am just kind of here for the ride and much rather shine the light on these horrific war hawks and get the actual things they've done while in power shown to the world. So today we are joined by Andrew Cushone, who's basically become kind of a co-host for the show, to go into some of the top Clinton crimes against humanities and just overall conspiracies that are not as widely publicized. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Very good, very good. Ready to get into some Clinton conspiracies.
So I'd like to start with a quote from Hillary that kind of gets to the core of what Hillary's all about. Politics is like sausage being made. It is unsavory, and it always has been that way. But we usually end up where we need to be. But if everybody's watching, then people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need both a public and a private position, unquote. In public, Hillary is a feminist who fights for women's rights. In private, she covers up her husband's rape crimes, gets money and arms sent to Islamic countries that stone women, gays, and atheists, and defends pedophiles. Now, many people don't know about that last one, but let's start with the first of Hillary's crimes against humanity. When Hillary Clinton defended a rapist. Quote, "It is the duty of all young women to support Hillary Clinton, and there's a special place in hell for those who do not." Those words were by Madeleine Albright just a few months ago. And yet I wonder, where in hell do those go who defend child rapists? Why do I ask this question? Because Hillary Clinton did just that and laughed about the fact that she knew he was guilty. She proceeded to defend the man and smear the rape victim's reputation for personal gain. Newly discovered audio recordings of Hillary Clinton from the early 1980s include the former First Lady's frank and detailed assessment of the most significant criminal case of her legal career, defending a man accused of raping a 12-year-old girl. In 1975, the same year she married Bill, Hillary agreed to serve as the court-appointed attorney for Thomas Alfred Taylor, a 41-year-old accused of raping the child after luring her into a car. If you want to imagine the stereotypical lurking child rapist, he was just that. Now, one might contest that she was simply doing her duty in defending a rapist, and Lord knows, how could she have known if he did it? Well, it actually turned out she did. She stated, "I had him take a polygraph, which he passed, which forever destroys my faith in polygraphs," unquote. She added a laugh at the end of it. Clinton can also be heard laughing at several points when discussing the crime lab's accidental destruction of DNA evidence that tied Taylor to the crime. In the case, Clinton did everything from suggest that girls like her fantasize about older men, that the client had a history of emotional instability, and that since she's from a disorganized family, she was apt to exaggerate everything. These allegations against the client were made up, according to reports from the complainant years later. So I ask you, if someone who defends someone she knows is a child rapist, by smearing a 12-year-old's reputation a hero for women, is there a special place in hell for this rape victim because she's not pro-Hillary?
One,
The governor's wife, Hillary Clinton, she talks to Sam Donaldson.
If you're married for more than 10 minutes, you're going to have to forgive somebody for something.
Some say she's his most powerful secret weapon.
The harder they hit, the more encouraged I get.
I've worked very hard on education reform, worked very hard on children's and family issues.
To deal with the problems that are affecting this country.
Some wonder whether she should be running for the White House.
But wouldn't you like to be president? Wouldn't you like to be president?
Good evening. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton has spent the past week trying to fight off a cloud of scandal that has endangered his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. Tonight we have an interview with the person who will deserve a large share of the credit if he succeeds, his wife, Hillary Clinton, who has not only stood by her man, but has led the counterattack against her husband's accusers. In some way, what is going on just now is a battle between two women for the public's favor, Jennifer Flowers, who says she had an affair with the governor, and Hillary Clinton, who says, well, she says quite a lot. Just listen.
We've got to have a long-term strategy to change this economy and start investing in people again.
We have to get a hold of our banking system.
Bill has said if he were president, among the things he would do would be to fully fund Head Start.
Every one of you involved. Thank you very much.
She is out front. She is outspoken. She is Governor Bill Clinton's primary defensive shield in his effort to overcome charges of marital infidelity. She is his wife. And for Hillary Rodham Clinton, these are days requiring great personal strength.
Have you heard the excerpts of those alleged tapes?
Yes, uh-huh. And read the transcript, sure.
When you hear someone whose voice, is it your husband on those tapes?
Who can tell? I don't have any idea. But he's talked to her. We know that. I sat there in the kitchen one night when he returned to call.
And
to
when
her.
You hear something like the transcript is correct, she signs off a conversation saying goodbye, darling, and he says goodbye, baby.
Oh, that's not true. That didn't happen. No, of course not.
Or he says, you know, they don't have the pictures.
Well, I'll tell you what. This was a woman who at least pretended that her life was ruined because somebody had alleged that she had a relationship at some point with Bill Clinton. Anybody who knows my husband knows that he bends over backwards to help people who are in trouble and is always willing to listen to their problems.
Why? You mean those telephone conversations, he was just trying to help her out?
Well, he the first time he called her, I mean, we were in the kitchen together, and he said, you know, this woman thinks her life is over, and he felt very sorry for her.
The truth is, I loved him.
Jennifer Flowers, who was paid by the tabloid star to tell her story involving Bill Clinton and to play her tapes of alleged Clinton phone conversations, has the look of every married woman's nightmare. Sleek, sexy, a blonde femme fatale.
Yes, I was Bill Clinton's lover for 12 years, and for the past 2 years I have lied to the press about our relationship to protect him.
Sam, if somebody's willing to pay you $130,000 or $170,000 to say something, and you get your 15 minutes of fame, and you get your picture on the front page of every newspaper, and you're some failed cabaret singer who doesn't even have much of a resume to fall back on, and what's there she's lied about, you know, that's the daughter of Willie Horton. As far as I'm concerned, it's the same kind of attempt to keep the real issues of this country out of the mainstream debate where they need to be.
Tough words. But unlike her husband, whose speech tends to round off the sharp edges, Hillary Clinton, campaigning this week in Colorado, drove home her points with a jackhammer. Although she says Flowers' bombshell came as a surprise to her.
I mean, if you had told me that 6 months ago, I would have laughed. I would have said, no way.
Well, would some people argue that all is fair in love, war, and politics?
Some people would, and some people would also say they would do whatever it took to be reelected, and it was a dog-eat-dog campaign.
So Jennifer Flowers, who was one of the first women that the Clintons were embroiled in a scandal that Bill was sleeping with, was called trailer trash by Hillary. So that was Hillary's means of discrediting Jennifer. Hillary slammed Monica Lewinsky, who we all know, as a, quote, narcissistic Looney Tune. Hillary offended an alleged rapist and smeared his 12-year-old rape victim, which is what you were just talking about there, Carlos. She referred to the various women that her husband was involved with, which is a large number. We just don't have time to go into all of them. She referred to them as bimbos, just blanketing all of them, including one of them that outright accuses Bill Clinton of rape. It doesn't look good for both of them at all. And Hillary, what we do know is that she has very callously treated the accusers. Of course, Trump's done the same to his accusers, but they're both horrible people. Absolutely. Well, you got the next one, Carlos.
Yeah, so, you know, if you heard any of our series on Islam, you know that there were a lot of Western influences that played a part, especially large part, inflating the already problematic Islamic religion. And Hillary and Obama have quite a few ties to radical Islam.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated, they lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is, wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow, because we will harvest. So we then left Pakistan. We said, okay, fine. You deal with the stingers that we've left all over your country. You deal with the mines that are along the border. And by the way, we don't want to have anything to do with you. In fact, we're sanctioning you. So we stopped dealing with the Pakistani military and with ISI, and we now are making up for a lot of lost time.
So outside of simply bombing the shit out of Islamic countries, the United States government loves giving weapons to the most radicalized groups and is kind of buddy-buddy with a country that regularly murders gays and atheists, Saudi Arabia. Now, Clinton and the Clinton Foundation loves giving weapons to these peaceful folks. In the International Business Times from May 26, 2015, there was an article titled, Clinton Foundation Donors Got Weapons Deals from Hillary Clinton's State Department. It stated that even by the standard of arms deals between the United States and Saudi Arabia, it was one of the most enormous deals in history. A consortium of American defense contractors, led by Boeing, would deliver $29 billion worth of advanced fighter jets to the United States' oil-rich ally in the Middle East. In late 2011, Hillary Clinton's State Department was formally clearing the sale and asserting that it was in the nation's best interests. Now, though Hillary Clinton enjoyed throwing around the word national interests, in newly leaked Hillary emails, Hillary admitted that she knew that the Saudis were funding ISIS.
Here is now another from the latest release of hacked emails from WikiLeaks. Hillary Clinton from August of 2014 claiming two U.S. allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, were funding and supporting ISIS. Quote, saying in part to an email to President Obama's then counsel John Podesta, we need to use our diplomatic and more traditional intelligence assets to bring pressure on the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, which are providing clandestine financial and logistics support to ISIL and other radical Sunni groups in the region, end quote. That's a mouthful, and that is important. John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Senior Fellow American Enterprise Institute, and a Fox News contributor. When you hear that, what do we have to understand about the context of that comment, sir?
Well, I think it's particularly important that Hillary Clinton says that the governments of these two countries are funding ISIS. Were the governments funding other radical Sunni groups in the region? Absolutely. And Hillary Clinton should know that very well, because they included funding of radical groups in Libya before and after the overthrow of Gaddafi that contributed to the destabilization there, ultimately leading to the tragedy in Benghazi on September the 11th, 2012.
So she knows that the weapons are going to terrorists, and she states that it's in the national interest. With the help of Clinton, our weapons have gone to such diverse forces for democracy in Syria as the Islamist militias operating under the moniker of the Free Syrian Army, whose leader defended Al-Qaeda, and the majority of whose commanders wanted to work with Al-Qaeda, Jaish al-Qassa, a former ally of ISIS, and Gohabra al-Sham, which had called for the slaughtering of Americans like cattle, and whose former leader had ISIS ties. The Free Syrian Army had included the Farouk Brigades, which forced non-Muslims to pay jizya taxes, and which became notorious when one of its commanders was filmed eating a heart. The Muslim Brotherhood's Tawhid Brigade, which was part of the Free Syrian Army, the Syrian Islamic Liberation Front, and the Islamic Front had called for imposing Sharia law in an Islamic state alongside Al-Qaeda. Despite the feverish enthusiasm of Democrats for running background checks on Americans buying guns in order to prevent some supposed mass shooting, the United States government is regularly smuggling weapons into the hands of individuals who find it necessary to crucify children, to regularly murder young women for doing things like having sex outside of marriage, or maybe even being prostitutes, or, heaven forbid, driving around in the car by themselves. Now, Andrew, I know that Hillary, of course, was one of the main reasons why we ended up going to war with Libya, correct?
Yeah, and that's even understating it, because she seems to be the only person who really wanted it.
What the Sanders campaign is trying to do is to link donations to my political campaign, or really donations to anyone's political campaign, with undue influence, with changing people's views and votes. I've never, ever done that.
Newly declassified emails belonging to Hillary Clinton reveal some new possible motives behind the intervention in Libya. The latest batch of correspondence released by the U.S. State Department containing information over the threat posed by Gaddafi's gold reserves. The documents say they could have been used to establish a pan-African currency able to compete with the dollar in the region. Libya's large oil reserves and protecting French influence in North Africa were also cited as reasons to intervene. However, back in 2011, Western leaders were hailing the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime as a victory for freedom and democracy.
Through their actions, they have lost the legitimacy to govern, and the people of Libya have made themselves clear. It is time for Gaddafi to go, now, without further violence or delay.
Well, 5 years on, amid the continued violence and chaos in Libya, extremists are gaining more power and territory. This week, dozens lost their lives in ISIL-related attacks.
Secretary Clinton pressured a wary President Obama to join France and the UK in the war, The Times reported, New York Times. Vice President Biden, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, and Defense Secretary Robert Gates, among others, opposed the war effort. So those are the most important people when it comes to military decisions. Everyone opposed it but Hillary Clinton, and Obama was very wary. Numerous government officials recalled that her hawkish enthusiasm was decisive.
Yeah.
So no Clinton, no war. She single-handedly pushed this as Secretary of State. And now maybe you think the war in Libya was a good thing, and Clinton seems to be really standing by it. Even Obama has apologized for it at this point. He said it was his biggest mistake, which is probably true. And Clinton, though, doesn't seem to have shown any remorse whatsoever. It's terrible.
Yeah, no shit. I mean, and what's interesting is, of course, you know, Saudi Arabia, who she acknowledged is helping fund and work with groups like ISIS, does seem to have one of the more cozy relationships with her.
We consider the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia a close and strategic partner in many of the critical issues facing our world today.
Right. So there was an article by the Washington Post titled Hillary Clinton's Gifts from Foreign Leaders More Lavish Than Those for Obama. Clinton had received gold jewelry worth $500,000 from King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. The State Department said the gift included a necklace, bracelet, ring, and earrings. The white gold was adorned with teardrop rubies and blood diamonds. But they didn't add in the blood diamonds part. You know, but the thing is that she goes for kind of a two-pronged approach, right? So she's not only about, you know, selling our money, our labor, our time, our life to radical Muslim groups, but she likes to play both sides of the fence whenever it comes to religious fanaticism by essentially arguing that our great Jewish allies in Israel will greatly benefit from the blood of Muslim children. Because, as mentioned by a pretty interesting one of the WikiLeaks, Andrew, if you want to bring this up, Hillary thought the Syrian war was a good thing for Israel.
Yeah, and of course it should be pointed out that Hillary is extremely pro-Israel, and specifically she's pro kind of the most hawkish of the hawks in Israel. She's very pro Netanyahu, and so what is good for Israel is what she wants. Well, what does she think is good for Israel in Syria? And let's just read a quote here from Hillary Clinton herself. She said, quote, "The best way to help Israel deal with Iran's growing nuclear capability is to help the people of Syria overthrow the regime of Bashar Assad. It is the strategic relationship between Iran and the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria that makes it possible for Iran to undermine Israel's security. Not through a direct attack, which in the 30 years of hostility between Iran and Israel has never occurred, but through its proxies in Lebanon, like Hezbollah, that are sustained, armed, and trained by Iran via Syria. End of the Assad regime would end this dangerous alliance. Israel's leadership understands well why defeating Assad is now in its interests."
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing because, you know, our relationship, well, not ours, right? I'm not really responsible for it, but the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel at the same time really starts to make you, you know, kind of loony whenever it comes to trying to understand, is it that they're trying to fight for a certain side, or is it more that they're just trying to vie for ultimate power in these areas?
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia funds ISIS, as Clinton admitted in that WikiLeaks you read earlier, and Israel, you know, seems to benefit from the civil war in Syria. So, you know, who knows? There's all these conspiracy theories about Israel also tacitly supporting ISIS. I don't know if I have any direct proof for that, but
yeah, I mean, there's some interesting stuff out there, but I don't try to dabble too much into that world. I was about to say in Alex Jones territory, but he doesn't seem to give a fuck about anything anymore outside of crying whenever Donald Trump isn't doing something positive. Hillary Clinton is Satan. And speaking of Satan, I did want to get into a little bit about Hillary's relationship with the media. And though Donald Trump, you know, says like, oh, well, you know, there's a whole media war against me and people kind of laugh, there's some little bit of truth to it, right? So The Intercept back in October 9th had a really interesting article called "New Email Leak Reveals Clinton Campaign's Cozy Press Relationship." As these internal documents demonstrate, a central component of the Clinton campaign strategy is ensuring that journalists they believe are favorable to Clinton are tasked to report the stories the campaign wants circulated. At times, Clinton's campaign staff not only internally drafted the stories they wanted published, but even specified what should be quoted on background and what should be described as on the record.
And an example of that in action is when Clinton got the town hall debate topics from the primary debate with Bernie Sanders in advance. And it's a little unclear the chain of who gave who what, but it's very clear that all these people give each other these questions in advance, because DNC chair Donna Brazile had the question before the town hall. And supposedly the question was also given to CNN at a later date. So Brazile had it before CNN. So I guess then the DNC or the debate commission probably gave it to both. But here's the quote from Politico. "The email obtained by Politico was written by town hall co-moderator Roland Martin on the day of the town hall two CNN producers. But it shows him using word for word the language of a question that Brazil appeared to have sent to the Clinton campaign a day earlier. That email from Brazil to the campaign was included in yesterday's release of hacked emails by WikiLeaks of Clinton campaign chair John Podesta. So these questions are known to Clinton, and in fact, they may have even been written by the Clinton campaign. That's one way to interpret that chain of how Brazil had the question even before CNN did.
Yeah.
Brazil is the chair of the DNC.
Yeah, and if you actually watch the debate, I mean, the entire thing was a big charade. It was absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, there was this kind of conspiracy that was kind of being washed around that made a little bit of sense, which is the idea essentially that Hillary used the media in order to push forward the more ridiculous of the candidates to make them look as if they're legitimate. Because Hillary Clinton is the kind of person who managed to lose to a black chain smoker with very little political history whatsoever and almost lost to a Jewish atheist communist from Vermont. I mean, her charisma isn't that outstanding, so she needs to ensure that she's going against someone who honestly is going to look so ridiculous that you feel as if you have to vote for Hillary. And then some wonderful information ended up coming out that might be the case. So it shouldn't be a shock to anyone who understands Clinton's capability for manipulation. But a series of emails recently obtained showed that the Clinton's campaign and the media, who's at her behest, pushed forward Trump. Now, I'm directly reading from an email here by the HRC campaign. It starts, "Our goals and strategy. Our hope is that the goal of a potential HRC campaign and the DNC would be one and the same, to make whomever the Republican nominate unpalatable to a majority of the electorate. We have outlined three strategies to obtain our goal. Number one, force all Republican candidates to lock themselves into extreme conservative positions that will hurt them in a general election. Number two, undermine any credibility trust Republican presidential candidates have to make inroads to our coalition or independence. Number three, muddy the waters on any potential attack lodged against HRC.
When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. And now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend, believe me, but they're killing us economically. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me, and I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words. I will immediately terminate President Obama's illegal executive order on immigration. Immediately.
Pied Piper candidates. There are two ways to approach the strategies mentioned above. The first is to use the field as a whole to inflict damage on itself, similar to what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012. The variety of candidates is a positive here, and many of the lesser known can serve as a cudgel to move the more established candidates further to the right. In this scenario, we don't want to marginalize the more extreme candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates who actually represent the mainstream of the Republican Party. Pied Piper candidates include, but are not limited to, shocker, Ted Cruz.
So I'm going to make a request directly to those reporters who are covering this proceeding to endeavor to have at least half of what you say be focused on the actual substance of this debate. Number one, just as a consumer, I'm a big fan of eating White Castle burgers. Some time ago, I tweeted a speech that Ashton Kutcher gave. That's a terrific speech. I don't know Mr. Kutcher. I've watched his TV shows and his movies. I don't know him personally. You look right now at one of the most popular television shows in the United States, Duck Dynasty. This is a show about a God-fearing family of successful entrepreneurs who love guns, who love to hunt, and who believe in the American dream. You might ask, what does that letter from Hobby Lobby have to do with Toby Keith's terrific song? One of the great philosophical conundrums with which we must all wrestle is whether Obamacare is more like Jason or Freddie. In fact, in my mind, I heard the music from The Shining, or not The Shining, from Psycho, in the shower scene. Mike Lee, I am your father. When my dad was a cook, the place he worked was a place called the Toddle House. Imagine a Denny's combined with a Benihana's. He also, I will credit my father, he invented, this wasn't for the restaurant, but he did it anyway, he invented green eggs and ham. Find your opportunities and always be sexy. Now, I salute that message. I think it's a message that I hope every young person in America hears.
Donald Trump.
China. You take China.
China.
Ben Carson.
Obamacare is really, I think, the worst thing that has happened in this nation since slavery.
Undermining their message and credibility. More of the more established candidates will want to focus on building a winning general election coalition. The Pied Pipers of the field will mitigate this to a degree, but more will need to be done on a certain candidates to undermine their credibility among our coalition, communities of color, millennials, women, and independent voters. In this regard, the goal here would be to show that they are just the same as every other GOP candidate, extremely conservative on these issues. Some examples, Jeb Bush. What to undermine the notion he is a moderate or concerned about regular Americans, perceived inroads with the Latino population. Marco Rubio, what to undermine the idea he has fresh ideas, his perceived appeal to Latinos. This is huge, folks. This is showing the perfect orchestration by HRC in order to push forward these ridiculous candidates, and it's worked. And sadly, everyone seems, well, at least way too many people seem, especially among people that I kind of used to consider friends, they've fallen for the trap. Now, Andrew, let's get into the domestic foreign terror cells, known as the prison industrial complex's influence on Hillary.
Look at her funders. If a candidate gets a lot of money from the oil industry, they're probably not going to sponsor, you know, climate change legislation. And who does Clinton get money for? Who are her money men? And from a political article, Clinton campaign gives private prison lobbyist cash to charity. The campaign disclosed that Richard Sullivan of Capital Council, which until recently was a Raleigh, North Carolina-based federally registered lobbyist for the for-profit prison operator GEO Group, bundled $69,363 in donations for Clinton in the fourth quarter. That's just in one quarter, bringing his total for the year to a whopping $274,891. This makes Sullivan the second most prolific lobbyist bundler for the Clinton campaign. So a private prison lobbyist is Clinton's second most prolific lobbyist bundler. And the bundlers are what really matters in the modern campaigns. The Koch brothers, for instance, they're mostly useful for their bundling rather than for the money they donate directly. And Clinton's bundling operation and her whole money machine is run by prison lobbyists.
Yeah, there was an interesting Intercept article called Private Prisons Lobbyists Are Raising Cash for Hillary. Fully five Clinton bundlers work for the lobbying and law firm Akin, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Felt. Correction Corporations of America, the largest private prison company in America, paid Akin, Gump $240,000 in lobbying fees last year. So the firm also serves as a law firm for the prison giant representing the company in court. Right, so Akin Gump lobbyist and Clinton bundler Brian Popper disclosed that he previously helped CCA defeat efforts to compel private prisons to respond to the Freedom of Information Act request. So Hillary has a really complicated history with incarceration, right? As First Lady, she championed, you know, efforts to get tough on crime. She said, "We need more police. We need more and tougher prison sentences for peed offenders." Clinton even said in 1994, the three strikes and you're out for violent offenders has to be part of the plan. We need more prisons to keep violent offenders for as long as it takes to keep them off the streets. So if you're getting in a bunch of money from the prison industrial complex in order to get more people thrown in prison, turns out you end up vying for certain laws in order to make that happen. And if you want to talk about honestly just ridiculously fucked up stuff, there was a bit of evidence that the Clintons ran a huge illegal scheme selling prisoners' blood for profit, which is pretty insane. So during Bill Clinton's gubernatorial tenure in Arkansas, the state prison system, which was self-supporting largely through inmate farm labor, collected and sold inmate blood, often taken from the riskiest elements of the prison population, right? So focusing on the state's notorious Cummins work farm, documentary Kelly Duda establishes through interviews with current and former inmates, prison phlebotomists, and others, the inmates commonly known to engage in Schedule 4 drug abuse and homosexual activities were allowed to bleed for $2 a pop. And although officially denied, their blood was then processed and sold illegal to sell in the United States, but the blood was distributed to Canada and used, among other things, to process Factor 8, a clotting medication sold to hemophiliacs. Now, the other matter, though, is kind of how much money the Clintons are actually getting over the last couple of years here. Would you like to talk a little bit about the Clinton Foundation?
The Clintons have been absorbing cash for 41 years. That's estimated at $3 billion, according to the Washington Post. That money has not come in the form of small grassroots donations, but rather in large handfuls by multimillionaires. Quote, a handful of elite givers have contributed more than $25 million to the foundation, including Canadian mining magnate Frank Giustra, who's among the wealthy foreign donors who have given tens of millions. They made historic inroads on Wall Street, pulling in at least $69 million in political contributions from the employees and PACs of banks, insurance companies, and securities and investment firms. Wealthy hedge fund managers S. Donald Sussman and David E. Shaw are among their top campaign supporters, having given more than $1 million each. The couple's biggest individual political benefactors are Univision chairman Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, who have made 39 contributions totaling $2.4 million to support the Clintons' races since 1992. Spons have also donated at least $10 million to the foundation. Lots of money floating around here.
Yeah, to act as if Univision's attacks on Trump's campaign has nothing to do with their huge investments in the Clintons is absolutely ridiculous. It's kind of like to act as if Wall Street's investments in her had nothing to do with the bailouts is even, you know, kind of more absurd. And to assume that a Canadian mining company's funding of her campaign has nothing to do with her views on foreign energy subsidies? Well, that's about as crazy as you get, because the truth is that Hillary has been bought and paid for more than a $2 prostitute in an all-male oil town. Now, when it comes to a lot of these allegations, though, there was the little matter of her trial. And in her trial, the FBI director kind of admitted that she did something wrong, but never really indicted her. Right, Andrew?
Yeah, so the FBI director has an interesting history with the Clintons. So the first thing to know about James Comey, and this is from the Independent Journal Review, the first thing to know about James Comey is that before he became the FBI director in 2013, he was a top executive at Lockheed Martin from October 2005 until July 2010. As former general counsel and vice president of Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor benefited under Comey's leadership from a number of contracts awarded by Hillary Clinton's State Department. So Comey as CEO got contracts from Clinton's State Department. Comey looks the other way when Clinton commits crimes. It seems like intent is there for both of them.
Yeah, no one really benefits within the power structure for her to actually go to jail, right?
Yep. Oh, and Lockheed Martin, by the way, has also just directly given money to the Clinton Foundation, as if, you know, the implicit bias wasn't enough.
Yeah, and shockingly, a lot of the money that was supposed to go to things like Haiti didn't end up going to them, but instead got kind of moved around in order to continue the endless amount of wars that the Clintons apparently want to push.
Hillary Clinton wants to be commander-in-chief, and she has more foreign policy experience than anyone running for president. She even brags about it when she can.
Yeah, I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time.
But she might not want to name drop a guy who orchestrated coups, propped up dictators, and probably violated international law. And experience isn't the same thing as success. What's Clinton's track record when it comes to U.S. intervention abroad, and why does it matter? Everyone knows that back in 2002, Senator Clinton voted for the invasion of Iraq. Even though she now admits that it was a mistake, has she learned from it? Well, her actions at the State Department are telling. Let's start with the bombing of Libya during the Arab Spring. Clinton was the Obama administration's most influential advocate in toppling the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Using flawed intelligence from Libyan opposition leaders, she pressured President Obama to join coalition forces, despite resistance from members of his cabinet. Following the death of Gaddafi, NATO bombing ended, but Clinton had no strategy for securing the country after his overthrow. The chaos that followed, free-flowing weapons and armed militias, have turned Libya into a country with competing governments, no rule of law, and a growing ISIS presence. Still, the former Secretary of State seems to be proud of her role in regime change in Libya.
Libya actually held elections. They elected moderates. They have tried to piece together a government against a lot of really serious challenges.
But Libya isn't the only case of Clinton's militaristic approach. Whenever the Obama administration was divided about using force, Clinton was on team intervention. She repeatedly advocated for the 2009 decision to send thousands of troops to continue the war in Afghanistan. Vice President Joe Biden and others opposed it. But even after leaving the State Department, Clinton has been vocal in her readiness to take on conflict around the world. When it comes to Iran, Clinton's publicly supported diplomacy and the deal. But at a time when the U.S. is dropping sanctions, Clinton says there should be new ones.
Which is really a very retrograde posture, something that's not shared by pretty much anyone within the Democratic Party.
On Syria, Clinton's distanced herself from Obama. She's called for a more aggressive approach, including a no-fly zone, more airstrikes, more special ops, and
ground forces actually taking back more territory from ISIS.
Then there's Latin America. Clinton's record points to leadership that talks a big game on democracy, but behind the scenes isn't all that interested in it. In 2009, she condoned a coup in Honduras, even though the United Nations and others condemned it. Clinton secretly negotiated with coup leaders to ensure fast elections and that the former president would not return. Since then, Honduras has been rife with drug violence and police corruption. It has the highest homicide rate in the world, which is part of the reason so many migrants have become U.S. asylum seekers. Given all that, who's Clinton hoping to attract with this record?
It's very difficult to perceive who within the Democratic primary electorate she's trying to woo over with an extremely hostile and antagonistic foreign policy.
So, is Hillary the commander-in-chief that Democrats want and that America really needs?
Now, the last topic I want to get into here is something that's actually been often ignored by a lot of the media, including the alternative media, whenever any kind of criticisms of Hillary Clinton have been brought up. And it's a topic that is very close to my heart, as well as many of the people, you know, who have followed my work regarding Child Protective Services, which is the Safe Family and Adoptions Act of 1977. Now, the act was, of course, pushed originally by Bill Clinton while he was in office, but Hillary gloats that she helped create it. When she says, "I worked with Tom DeLay, one of the most partisan of Republicans, to reform the adoption and foster care system," this is the law she's talking about. The law is called the Adoption of Safe Families Act, ASFA. But that's, of course, a nice Orwellian title that Congress loves. It's not actually about adoption. It's not about safe families. It was passed in 1997, 1 year after the famed welfare law, and it ended up hitting a very similar target. ASFA was about demonizing impoverished women, especially women of color, and taking away their children. Here's what ASFA did. It encouraged a take-the-child-and-run mentality on the front lines of child welfare. Thousands more families, overwhelmingly poor and disproportionately families of color, were destroyed by wrongful removal of the children. Instead of reducing the foster care population, it increased it, trapping thousands more children in a system that, according to one major study, turns out walking wounded 4 times out of 5. It effectively turned the child welfare system into the ultimate middle class entitlement. Step right up and take a poor person's child for your very own. And when the army of childless yuppies didn't show up to adopt, and anywhere near the numbers predicted, ASFA created a generation of legal orphans, with no ties to birth parents and no adoptive homes either. Probably at least 100,000 more such legal orphans than had ASFA not become law. ASFA encouraged the misuse and overuse of foster care in much the same way as the crime bill encouraged mass incarceration. And just as the crime bill hurt entire communities of color, so does ASFA. So, as Dorothy Roberts, professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, writes in her book, Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, the removal of all these children disrupts the family and community network that prepare children to participate in future political life. And this needless removal of children reinforces the very stereotypes about black families that are used to excuse such removals in the first place. All of this is based off of a set of false premises. False premise one, any parent who loses a child to foster care is a sadist, a brute, a hopeless addict who puts drugs ahead of the children. But in fact, far more common are cases in which family poverty is confused with neglect. And whenever you think about the fact that 80% of removals are not for physical or sexual abuse, you also start to realize the fact that, for one, these cases of extreme neglect are actually quite rare, and that, two, because so many resources are spent on these trite nonsense allegations of child abuse that just truly are not abusive whatsoever, whether that be a child who's allowed to play outside of their home or a parent smoking pot, those resources are then not being used to go against actual predators. False premise two. An earlier federal law passed in 1980 requiring reasonable efforts to keep families together supposedly led to some children being left in dangerous homes and other children languishing in foster care. In fact, the law did nothing to change the federal financial incentives that encourage foster care and discourage better alternatives. So the number of children taken from their parents kept right on increasing in almost every year after that law was passed. And though known cases of child abuse peaked in 1993, entries into foster care still kept going up. The reason children languish in foster care was the failure to make reasonable efforts to keep families together in the first place. So, meanwhile, in 1994, soon-to-be House Speaker Newt Gingrich made his notorious proposal to consign poor people's children to orphanages. Republican polling guru Frank Luntz sent House Republicans a memo telling them they could get what they wanted if they stopped using the O word. So suddenly, the Republicans started framing the issue in terms of adoption. They told us millions of childless Americans were desperate to adopt foster children, but a vast family preservation conspiracy supposedly was trapping the children in foster care. The Republicans knew better. A lot of Democrats were suckered. ASFA passed nearly unanimously. Bernie Sanders, of course, voted for it too. By 2000, one of the authors of ASFA, Richard Gales, Dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania, couldn't resist a little bit of gloating regarding the honestly awful aspects of what he did. As he explained to the New York City publication Child Welfare Watch, quote, initially, this was just supposed to be a safe families bill, not really an adoption bill at all. The adoption component was a way of sanitizing the bill to make it more appealing to a broader group of people. Adoption is a very popular concept in the country right now, unquote. So the ASFA blows huge holes in what little was left of the reasonable efforts requirements. Pays states bounties of thousands of dollars per child for adoptions over a baseline number. And since the states can keep the money, even if the adoption fails, it encourages quick and dirty slipshod placements. Most important, ASFA sent a message to the child welfare front lines. Rush to take away more children. And it sent that message to a system permeated with class bias and racial bias. So even as child abuse continued to decline, the number of children in foster care on any given day kept increasing year after year after year. Notwithstanding all the talk and the bounties, adoption increased marginally, while the number of legal orphans, children who languish in foster care for years and then age out with no home at all, soared to 40%. Now, I know this is just scratching the surface of Hillary's evil actions. From the Arkansas drug trade to Benghazi, there's dozens of more things we could jump into. And I'm sure in due time, during the at least 4 years of Hillary's future presidency, we'll hit on more. In Hillary's moves to gain respect over the decades by projecting a toxic idea of strength, she's the embodiment of the corruption of power and the psychopathic mindset of those who seek it above all else. She is the worst of us. But that doesn't mean that she will prevent a better future for good. Technological innovations, like the internet, which has allowed me to be able to speak to you right now, have led to the openings of conversations that have helped grow free-thinking minds to discard the dogmatic dictates of despots, and instead look towards the liberation of the collective psyche to move towards a better tomorrow. Every one of us is capable of saying no more war, no more lies, no more death for the benefit of a chosen few. Let us not be taken by the temptations of democratic mob rule. Let us not be swayed by the men who want us to die for a flag that is drenched in blood. Let us instead seek to abolish the murderous machine which grinds up the physical and emotional lives of millions of men, women, and children. We are better than this. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and of course, Andrew, for being on the show. If you want to support it, you know, you can always donate at libertarian-atheist.com/donate. I'm very thankful every single day for the people who take the time to do that. And of course, make sure to subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. Enjoy your day, everyone. Hug your loved ones. And just remember, just because the political machine is on fire doesn't mean it needs to destroy your life. Enjoy. Bye.